Give me a home among the gum trees with lots of plum trees. A sheep or two, a kangaroo, a clothesline out the back, veranda out the front, and an old rocking chair.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Meta. I'm your host, Jay Larson, and joining me this week, we have a very special guest, one James Morehouse.
Did you forget my name?
No, I did not.
Or were you just searching for a relevant nickname?
None of the above.
It's pretty hard to find a relevant name for me these days, but thanks, mate. Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, James, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. My name's James Morehouse. I live in Canberra, Australia, which is probably closest to the famous Sydney Meta that have sort of stormed two WTCs. I'm, in terms of my War Machine resume, I'm a Circle player, returning Circle player. My resume is probably a bit dated, but most notably I won Lock and Load Masters 2014, which I think was the biggest ever Masters event for War Machine. I got the Australian Super Series 2 years back-to-back, which was kind of your Warfare weekend, War Machine weekend. And I have the infamous loss of the War Machine Hordes WTC in 2015, which saw me take a break from the game for a while. So the resume was looking pretty good, and I was happy with that, but then I took some time off to focus on things like careers and houses and CrossFit and... Yeah, I'm having a brief foray back into the game now, which hopefully turns into a long-term thing.
Awesome. Another thing that you did once upon a time with one Trent Dennison was a podcast called Oz Machine.
Yeah, that was an awesome time. I think we did about 80 episodes and then 50 special episodes on top of that with the infamous Simon Hall, Ben Leeper, who was our third host, talking about all the various Australian meta things. We've been playing together since late 2010, and then we all took a bit of time off from about 2016 onwards. So there was a glorious 5 years or so there where we were casting every week as well. And yeah, we'd love to bring it back if the circumstances were right, but it's hard to get everyone on the same page for games these days, especially when we're so spread out. Oz Machine lives on in everyone's hearts, and I must commend you on your intro music as well. Really appreciate that.
There was really no other choice.
Yeah.
So real quick, I'll go over the format of the meta. So we'll have some questions from people who do the $2 backer level on Patreon. And we'll have our first episode that'll be around 45, 50 minutes. And then we'll do a second episode, a bonus episode, where we continue the conversation. So let's just jump in and start going through some questions.
Okay.
So first we have Brother Scott. He says, what brought Mr. Morehouse back to the game?
Great question to kick things off with. So that WTC definitely hurt. Ironically, in the Circle Discord, there's a guy who's, I can't remember his name right now, sorry, but he's testing a bot and it calculates odds. So for example, if a buffed World Guardian charges a Slayer and hits the first attack, he's got 100% chance to destroy. But if he misses, then you should have boosted. Anyway, does numbers and calculations for him. And as a point of contention, he's been calculating what the odds were of me winning that pulling off that WTC assassination. The infamous Throne Kruger Megalith fluff. And he keeps coming out with 93 to 94%. So that one stings a bit. After that, took a bit of a break, to focus on career and things. And I needed a bit of space, not from gaming for that reason, but just I am a consultant in my professional life. And that 2016, that was taking 60, 70, sometimes 80 hours a week. So I sort of threw myself into that and really didn't touch gaming for about a year. And then I dabbled in, I've always and missed real, it, always had real, a hankering. Yep.
Real quick, before you leave that WTC experience, I will say, so I was friends with both you and Trent and your WTC team at the time. And I was at that WTC as well.
Mm.
And you and Trent both had a very competitive mindset. And there are certain teams who, as they're prepping for WTC, they feel like, okay, we have a chance at winning this. And you guys had that view. And you also, like, the amount of, you guys were super focused in, like a razor.
Totally.
And you were spending a lot of time. It was just something where you guys had worked hard. And so I do think that was a lot of setup to make what ended up happening hurt even more.
For sure. It was definitely a primary focus in our lives at that point.
Right.
And I think I can definitely speak for myself when I say I felt the need to prove something then.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
These days, that's all done. I guess I play for fun.
Right.
But at the time, I definitely had to prove something. And when you think about the time and effort and money that goes into that, especially for the Aussies, you know, it's essentially $2,000 in flights return just to get there and to get the time off. And you can't just pop over for a weekend. So right. We make a bit of a trip of it. And as a result, you do want to do that with a strong friendship group. If you're going with people that, you know, you really only have one thing in common with, it's not going to be a great experience. And as a result, we had such an awesome friendship group around that. So it was this group of friends who were working their ass off. So I guess the stakes were high for us then.
I think also one of the things that happened with you guys was that there came a point where you were examining yourselves and your lives and were kind of like, you know, why am I dedicating this much time and this much energy and this much money to this thing?
The return on investment in the grand scheme of life is pretty low.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it is. I will say, on the one hand, you had some experiences and you had some time with friends that in a lot of ways were irreplaceable. But on the other hand, if something like this is the primary focus of your life for as long as it was for you guys, then I think that sometimes it can be detrimental to other aspects of your life.
I think what I'm hearing you say is we need to move the WTC to Australia.
That would be amazing.
imagine. Maybe if we pulled it off 5 times, we could finally have a go in Australia. You're spot on, though, Jay. If you're dedicating all your leave and time and tying your ego to your ability to succeed in this game, which is fundamentally at the end of the day a game of dice and percentages, it's going to hurt. It's going to be detrimental.
Yeah.
So,
and I know people who... And I guess it's maybe a testament to War Machine that it's a deep enough game that it can even take this
hold
level
someone's attention for that long.
Right, right. That it can take this level of obsession from a person. But I've seen people who have had that level of obsession and because of it, it's hurt their careers or it's hurt their personal relationships or, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So.
Mm-hmm. Spot on, Jay. I think it's all about balance and I'm probably at that stage where I'm looking at starting a family and those kind of things where you just couldn't continue this lifestyle. Do I regret any of it? No, but there's really nowhere, like this might sound harsh and I don't want to throw anyone off here, but compare it to something like, let's say, Fortnite, right? Or the esports arena in general. So let's say you pull off a Chris Davies, which is you win absolutely everything. You're the only person to win 2 WTCs in the world, as far as I know. You win War Machine Weekend. You just win everything, right? No one will ever repeat that, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you go from here? You don't have sponsorships. You don't have, like, you've got awesome friends. You've done a bunch of great things, but you can't make a career out of it or a life out of it.
Right.
The only people that can are people like you who are running a business or in some other way involved. But that is not to do with being the best at the game. It's about growing a business, etc. So I don't think that if you do, you really get diminishing returns the more that you invest into this. I mean, Chris has thousands of women lining up at his house every day that are trying to get in there and give him their attention. But other than that, where else do you go? Whereas Fortnite and esports, there are so many people making a living out of it. Yes, it's tough and it's miserable. But there's a 16-year-old who's now won something like $3 million from playing Fortnite. I'm sure his parents are stoked. But there are actually avenues to go. I don't think War Machine can ever get that big that people can make careers off it. Do you?
No.
So especially in this sort of golden age of tabletop gaming and board games, diminishing returns on the investment in War Machine, for sure. And I think that happened to us back in 2015. So we took a well-needed break and did some different things.
And I will say that it also seems like it seems like this is a game where if you're wanting to do it competitively and travel the con circuit, etc., it's a little bit easier depending on what phase of life you're in, which you kind of touched on as well. Like when you were really hitting this hard previously, you didn't have a family, you didn't have some of these other things that can make it a little bit more difficult. So, but I also
I was ugly. I had no prospects in life. I was working at Macca's. But yeah, of course, and you're spot on.
But I'll also say that if you are in that stage of your life where you can do that, then great. You know, seize the opportunity, have fun, etc. But I guess it would be kind of like what you said, where you just need to go into it with the eyes open of what your realistic expectations are. You know, you're not going to make millions of dollars. You're going to be you're going to be spending a lot of money for some fantastic experiences, but it's never going to be, you know, like you said, making millions of dollars as you.
By all means, go for it. But just have an honest conversation with yourself and check in and say, do I have my priorities right? Do I have a bit of balance? And if your priority is being the best War Machine player in the world and you can do it sustainably, go for it. But make sure you have an honest conversation with yourself. Yes, this has got a bit philosophical and funny, but I mean, I do not regret a single thing that I did in my tabletop gaming career, let's call it.
The photo before the finals.
I regret that one. You got me. I've worked at some of the big four accounting and consulting firms now, and one of the funny things I put on the end is my hobbies. I play strategic war games, and the amount of hilarious conversations or door opening conversations or friendships that I've built out of that, the amount of professional nerds that are out there in the consulting world is astonishing. I mean, I've met people who were beta testers for the original Counter-Strike, who were on the original testing for Lord of the Rings by Games Workshop. It exists out there in professional capacities as well, and it supplements a lot of people's careers. So just keep it. It can be in a really healthy position in your life and supplement what your career.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, it can go back to what you were saying before, talking about balance. In that, you know, if you don't have these hobbies or you're just working all the time or whatever, then you get to the point where you're like, you know, why am I even doing this or what's the purpose of, et cetera. So
exactly. So in terms of answering the original question, just needed to go and check in and do some other life things first. For those of you who've been following, Trent has been he's been promoted a few times in his work, and I think he's now a regional manager. His painting has gone absolutely ballistic. He's really leveled up as a painter, and he's been focusing on busts and larger than 28 mil, so things like 54 mil at a minimum, but also the busts, which I think are about 80 to 100 mil scale or larger. And Benny, he's gone away and done some study and finished that and focused on his
and
career, and we've and all got like lovely girlfriends now, and
Benny got fucking ripped as well.
Benny was always ripped. He just got more.
That's
ripped.
True. That's okay. Fair.
He's amazing. So to answer the question, I think it's two things. Number one, the timing felt right. I needed the cognitive excitement, and I'm very stable in my career now that I needed to come back. And I did dabble in Age of Sigmar. And it did give me the little nostalgia hit I needed, but it wasn't the competitive, tactical and numerically driven game I was looking for. And then Games Workshop deleted my army out of the game. Thank you very much, Games Workshop, which was High Elves. But then number two, also mates like Trent, Benny, one of the guys I work with, Aaron, Pants. I have a lot of friendships with those guys that facilitated by games. And it felt like a good way to stay in touch with them as well. So a little bit selfish, but a way to stay in touch with that friendship group. Like I said, the guys that go to the WTC each year, they put together such an amazing group and have such a great time. So hell, who knows if things go well, maybe WTC 2020 or 2021.
Awesome.
Great question. Thank you. Bit philosophical.
This kind of ties in a little bit to what you just covered, but Joji asks, what did James find appealing about Age of Sigmar 2.0?
Yeah, good question again. So they, really brief history lesson, Age of Sigmar came out, it was a bit of a joke, honestly, in terms of from a competitive lens.
It also, like
yep,
the stuff that was like, oh, if whoever has the bigger beard gets...
Yeah, if you kneel before the Tomb King, you will get sixes on all your dice or whatever.
Right.
So some comedic elements to them. But then I think they did a lot. They have a few good mechanics in the game that make it very strategic. They refined a lot of the dice mechanics, essentially. They brought out a pack. It has scenarios in it. The scenarios are pretty balanced. There are some of them that are great. Some of them that are like, look, if you get first turn, you probably win. But overall, like having the equivalent of a steamroller pack is a huge step forward for them. As well as the models are beautiful. I really wanted, as a kid, I always wanted to collect High Elves from Warhammer Fantasy, but I didn't have the money to do what I wanted to do. So, i.e., that was have armies of Swordmasters, White Lions, Phoenix Guard, Phoenix Temple, and Dragon Princes and Dragons. In Age of Sigmar, they have a faction that is entirely Dragons. They have a faction that is entirely Phoenix Temple. So I thought, bugger it. I am going to indulge 12-year-old James now. And got I got two High Elf armies professionally painted and pushed them around the table. And was really enjoying it. But... yep, my faction was deleted out of the game. That's pretty fun. Hopefully we see a resurgence from High Elves. But also, GW is pretty famous for power creep, and it definitely exists in Age of Sigmar, and it's really hard for the lesser factions to keep up. CanCon this year, 2019, was a 192-player tournament, biggest Age of Sigmar tournament in the world. For solo, and day one I was coming first. I was on maximum kill points, maximum objectives, maximum scenario thing I was achieved. Day two I lost every single game to just sort of weird gotcha things like Grimghast Reapers summoning 60 dead Grimghast Reapers onto the table in a turn, Daughters of Cain just being an incredibly powerful army. So I guess the imbalance and power creep threw me there, faction being thrown out of the game. Time to have a look at something new, but it was an enjoyable experience. I think you can have a lot of great games in Age of Sigmar. I do think they could benefit from what I think they call an ITC pack, which is the 40K competitive pack.
Mm-hmm.
A few community rules for things like the equivalent of their WTC.
I remember when you were in pretty hard on the Age of Sigmar stuff. We had several conversations, and you at the time you were raving quite a bit about how strategic the game was and just what a enjoyable experience it was. You mentioned the power creep a little bit. What I guess were there any other ways that your opinion may have adjusted as you played more of the game, or what was your overall opinion of the game?
Yeah, I played about 12 months worth, and I had some decent results. The power creep wasn't as bad as till I would say the last 6 months has been probably worse. Ever since the new Skaven and what was the other faction at the time? Skaven and can't remember. Faction was rehashed, and then Slaanesh came out as a new faction, and they can essentially summon summon very overpowered things very easily. Basically, when Slaanesh units are wounded, they get things called depravity points, and then they can use those points to summon units back to the table. Summoning is a mechanic that makes movement. Movement sort of falls into three categories in Age of Sigmar. You're either slow, medium, or fast. Really fast is things like you're moving 30 plus inches in a turn. Slow is you're moving 10 or less. But also charges are random. They're 2d6. And a lot of summoning and some of the newer factions get around this, as in they can essentially plonk anywhere onto the table, and then they get, like, very roughly it's a 50% chance of charging you on a rerollable 9 on 2 dice. So, yeah, a couple of power creepy summony things that I look have it's an impressive business model, because if you can summon models to the table, it is in your advantage to have a whole plethora of different things that you can summon. So to be honest, we've actually seen a tiny bit of this in War Machine, like the Well of Orboros. It's in your benefit to take every single solo. Look, most circle players are going to have every single solo worth less than 5 points. But Infernals, I guess, raise that question. If you don't have access to everything that you want to be able to summon, you are probably doing yourself a disservice. Again, nowhere near as bad as Sigma, but I'm using a lot of negative words to describe it, but it is a very, very different game. So the more I played, the more I saw summoning coming into the game. It just removed some of those very strategic elements of the game to me. In War Machine, you are really rewarded for knowing models inside and out. In Age of Sigmar, you can get away without having to know everything. I certainly didn't know everything, and I had some very good results. And it was more just knowing that, you know, like, my 20 Phoenix Guard can probably take on this hero, and very roughly you can calculate odds a lot more easily because you have a static 2 hit and 2 wound. So if you have 60 attacks that hit on threes, well, then 40 out of 60 on average will hit. And then wound on threes, well, 27 will wound. And they have an armor save of 4+, well, 13 will go through, 13 or 14. You can do some very quick numbers knowing absolute minimal information about your opponent. So it's really less about the tactics and the micro of the game and more about spatial awareness and summoning and movement shenanigans. And if you can control movement and summoning, you'll win most of your games. High elves have zero summoning, period. So I just couldn't compete in a lot of those in a lot of those games. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. Cool. Okay.
Good question.
So continuing on, what about Circle continues to draw him back to the faction?
Circle have always been my babies. I've actually started War Machine with Trolls back in 2010 because I loved the appearance. And I first played Kalandra, which was a bit of a dice-fixing caster. Since then, I cycled through basically all Hordes factions that were out then. I played a lot of Legion, Scorn, played Kador, Sigmar when I was living in the United States. Bit of Rhett, but then I always found myself just coming back to Circle, and honestly, it was from Shifting Stones. I loved tricks. I love movement tricks, and it just felt like I could see the Matrix more with their movement tricks more than any other faction lent themselves. Also loved the aesthetics. I always picked druids and hunters and that kind of thing in any sort of role-playing game or RPG or anything, really. So I've always loved that faction. I played Hunters in Gilbor. I play the Elves in Lord of the Rings. Played Elves in Age of Sigmar. So
did you consider any, so from when you kind of quit the game, sold your army, you ended up coming back. In between that time, there's a new Hordes faction with Grimkin. Did that faction pique your interest at all, or were you just kind of drawn strictly to Circle?
Initially, no. I've always been like, you should just pick the aesthetic of the army that you like. But I spent a lot of flights and trips and things just reading everything in War Room again, because the game's entirely new to me. Half of it's new and the other half has changed through CID, so everything's new again, which is honestly a really exciting place to be. When I went through Grimkin, I really fell in love. I can easily see myself playing Grimkin as a second faction. Again, the tricks, the trap card element of it, the Yu-Gi-Oh! Gotcha, really appealing. Yeah, for sure. The aesthetic didn't grab me initially, but I'm warming to it. I worry about cockatrices. They really seem to define the meta. And I worry that, you know, one or two little nerfs to them and you could see a completely different faction. So I do dislike how heavily they seem to be dependent on the cockatrice. Again, take this with a grain of salt. I'm relatively new returning. So love the Arcana. Very well designed faction. Well done to Pagani and Co. as well.
And I guess I would say, even if the cockatrices did get an adjustment or two, the faction was quite strong.
So politically correct. An adjustment. A debuff.
An anti-buff.
An unchanging. Yeah.
They were doing well even before they received the Clockatrice. And in that same wave, they received a bunch of other exciting things as well. And so I think the faction is going to be fine regardless. But they are one that I can understand you coming back home to Circle, but it is one that I could see fitting you or whatever. So
yeah, no, I you're not the first and you probably won't be the last to say that.
Yeah.
Tom Guan, give me that Clockatrice army you're talking about. Yeah. I've always leaned towards Hordes as well. I haven't nearly enjoyed War Machine as much as I've enjoyed Hordes. And I think I think a bit of that comes down to the way that the Fury mechanic operates as well, and that your turns can be a bit more fluid. And so that's reflected in Circle and Grimkin as well.
Yeah, yeah.
I do, again, on the micro faction thing as well, the limited factions, I'm really impressed that Grimkin seem to be doing super well, or in the top, you know, three or so factions that seem to be floating around. I would like to see maybe a little bit more consideration given to the other limited factions that don't seem to be doing nearly as well.
Well, I mean, so...
Defend the other factions, Jay.
Okay, I will. Easy peasy. I mean, the first one is Convergence, and I think basically everyone agrees that they probably do need an additional looking to, but the good news is that they're the faction that's going to happen with once we're done with Oblivion releases. So
sure.
they're the next big update. The next one, Crucible Guard, is I think much more an issue of perception than reality. I think that there's a lot of people who, for whatever reason, I think that people weren't as drawn to the aesthetic of Crucible Guard, and I don't think that I don't think that as many people pick them up as some of the other factions. And so, you know, for example, in America, we had Brandon Owens on the meta recently, and he's been doing great, winning lots of stuff. It's kind of funny. One of the regional events in America just happened, the Phoenix Open. By far the biggest most played faction at that one was Crucible Guard.
Cool.
They had five Crucible Guard players, and Peter Lippert ended up winning the event with Crucible Guard. And so I think that overall they're actually just fine.
And it's always encouraging when you see players who have obviously proven themselves and could pilot anything win with these factions.
And then if anything, a lot of the players are concerned about Infernals potentially being too good. So I don't think we need to be too concerned about Infernals yet.
I wonder if Jay has any want for them to do well or plans on playing them. Yep.
I mean, I have enjoyed Infernals quite a bit, so that's been fun.
Exciting times ahead.
Yeah. Final two questions from Joe G. What's the best War Machine podcast of the last 10 years, and why is it Oz Machine?
Say no more. Answered your question, mate.
more seriously.
I really miss the original Musecast. Those guys had a good energy.
Yeah. That's never getting back together.
Yeah. 40K is a great game.
But I guess more seriously, what would you say you gained from the experience of doing Oz Machine?
Good question. Obviously, I have a lifetime friendship with Benny and Trent. So that's number one. This is a bit of a weird one. Number two, I watched or observed my presentation skills change, which I actually think has been useful in the workplace. Talking to someone through a computer is hard, especially when you can't see them. So if you can do that, you can facilitate workshops. You can do a bunch of different things. Number three, I feel like I have sort of a, and this is very lucky, a global community of people who would look out for me or would love to say hi, or, you know, if I said, like, I was in Boston in July for work / uni, and I had multiple people reach out and say, hey, can I have a game? And I unfortunately couldn't, but that community sort of, the global community exists, and the world's a very small place as a result of social media and consequently Oz Machines. So it's really nice knowing that there are, you know, other nerds out there who sort of got each other's back. So that's really nice. On a sort of literal translation of what you said, we had a fundraiser as well for when Trent and I qualified for Iron Gauntlet, for people to help us get over there. And again, when the guys from Australia make such a big commitment to go to the WTC and Lock and Load in a year, it's financially stressful. So that was a huge, huge help. It wouldn't have happened without any of the guys that donated. So I often think about Whaley's mate from Tassie, who donated $200 to us, and he just said, "Oh, just have an awesome time." Like, what a legend. So that community exists, and look, if the stars align, I'd love to get Trent and Benny on again. It's not I'm not the bottleneck for this one.
Sure, yeah.
Have you had? I'm sure you've had similar experiences with Chain Attack and the meta and that kind of thing. But Chain Attack's been, like, you know, consistently one of the A+ podcasts. I'm sure you've had similar experiences.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's nice about doing Chain Attack is that, you know, obviously it's ended up opening a lot of doors in my life. It's created a lot of friendships. You know, just thinking, for example, either you or like Aaron Well now comes over and visits us once a year. And initially he was just someone who, you know, hit me up and he's like, you know, I'm going to be visiting my family in Salt Lake City and I'd like to come see you guys. And at the time I didn't really know him at all. But
little did you know that an angel from heaven was knocking on your door.
Exactly, correct. But in some ways it's like it's kind of cool or nice to be like a Z-list internet celebrity, that because you don't have any of the drawbacks of being actually famous. Like I think that being an actual celebrity would be fucking awful.
Yeah.
But you get the benefits of, like you said, I feel like I could do a post on Facebook and be like, I'm going to be an X random city, you know, who wants to do something? And there's a really good chance that I would actually get a response to that. And
you rally the troops. Yeah. And that's comforting as well. You immediately go into a comfort zone. I was reading on Instagram the other day, the Brock, he can't do anything. Like he can't go to a cafe. He can't have a, it's impossible. Yeah. So right. The only way he can do it is he literally has to hire out an entire island. So whether it's the Caribbean or the South Pacific or whatever.
Yeah.
So that he's like, you know, one of three people on the island.
Yep.
Yep, definitely some benefits. I don't think any of us would say this is the reason we do it. We do it out of love for friends and stuff. But knowing that community could sort of rally, that's comforting. That's unreal.
Well, then final question from Joe G. Were you going to Harvard not for the degree, but basically to get funding for your harebrained startup that's basically Uber for cats?
Joe, you clearly don't know me. I'm a dog person, not a cat person. But
I'll try not to hold that against you.
I was at Harvard. I'm doing a MBA through there through work, which is a pretty life-changing experience, actually. Uber for cats. I don't know how they'd use it or why, but I mean, would the cats drive the cars for other cats?
No, I think it's humans that are doing.
Oh, humans are enslaved by cats.
Yes, yes.
Right. So, like, basically just
the natural order. Yeah.
Cat owners. I can see that's something you'd do, Jay.
Driving Uber
for cats.
I mean, that sounds like living my best possible life.
No doubt. No doubt.
Cool.
Thanks, Joe. Great question. Ban Joe from questions. Cheers.
Okay. From Dr. Glenn, this is going to riff a little bit off of the earlier question on picking factions. He says, did he pick a brand new faction when he came back or play something he had before? And what was the thought process behind it? I'll add a little bit onto that as well. If let's say that you had decided to keep playing War Machine after that fateful WTC, do you think that when it went through the transition to Mark III and that stuff, do you think that you could have stayed with Circle? Or I've had some times where, whether it's like say Haley 2 getting nerfed or whatever, where sometimes even though a faction may still be good, it's so different from what I had fallen in love with that it felt like I needed some time apart from it.
Romantic quickly. I know what you mean.
Yeah.
Good question. Number one, I don't know. Even if we'd won, I don't know if we actually would have, you know, stuck with it and kept going hard.
Right.
That's a conversation I've had with the guys a few times, actually, because we had this whole idea of, like, I guess, you know, checking off the bucket list, essentially. And you got to remember, for someone like Trent as well, he'd been to the WTC for Warhammer a few times, and that is super competitive as well. I think the best Australia's ever done at that event was Trent's last year there, where they also came fourth, which would have been back in about 2009-ish, 10-ish, probably 9. I don't know if we would have. So it's kind of hard to answer that question because I kind of had some other stuff to do in my life anyway. If I had, I didn't follow it as closely as I probably should have, but I understand that early Mark III that they've been playtesting for 500 years took a while to sort out its teething issues, and that's part of, I think, why maybe I've come back at a good time as well. Mark III through to Mark 3.5, it sounded like they just needed to go through this whole themes cycle. Because the game has become so large, I do understand the need for essentially sub-factions within factions, which I think has, upon revisiting, a lot of benefits. So I don't know if I would have enjoyed being part of that process. And quite honestly, I don't. I found CID a good thing for them to go through, but I'm glad I wasn't involved. The amount of chopping and changing of models that the community are playtesting and have a voice and managing that from a private PP's perspective, that would have been a nightmare to project manage. So in a way, I think I've maybe been fortunate having some time away from it. And I think you can remind me, Jay, Circle was not good at the start of Mark III, and they were very, very different. Is that right?
It was definitely... They were viewed as one of the weaker factions, I think, it's kind of the start of Mark III. Yeah. Mm.
And from what I've also seen, there were a few...
It got to where there was some European players that were sticking with Circle and started doing well, and a lot of times it ended up being like a double bones pairing.
I think there's still a little bit of a way to go, from what I know, to make the living war beast a bit more attractive. But at the end of Mark II, I had, you know, Bradigus and 8 World Watchers, Chromac 2, and I was playing like 7 Arguses, 3 sets of Shifting Stones, like all these things that basically don't see the light of day anymore. And I've now got a shelf in my room that just has two shelves of Circle, and it's probably about half the faction, but it's about 99% of the lists that I want to run. So whereas back then I had absolutely everything. I had like 2 units of Wolves of Orboros and just like everything under the sun that you could possibly need. So it's nice being able to take a break, come back in with fresh eyes. I don't know. I think I would have been pretty salty about like all the circle that I have and that I'm only using 10% of it, and that the faction identity has changed so much as well. Like even Lightning Strike going from cost 2 range 6 to cost 1 range self, that's huge. I mean, Circle would play their entire games around sprinting things that probably shouldn't have sprint, like Morag. Or sprinting Getarix. So you've got a sprinting Stalker, a sprinting Getarix, and maybe one other sprinting caster in the same turn. The faction identity change has been wild. So now coming back, it's been, very refreshing to look at. I think I would have dabbled in other things, got frustrated, maybe had a break anyway. So, I mean, it's hard to sort of guess what would have happened. But in hindsight, I'll consider myself fortunate.
So the next couple of questions come from one Michael Chili Winners.
Oh, shit. Here we go.
His first question, he says, James, how much do you bench these days? This is the type of content that listeners crave.
Bench is my weakest lift. I think I haven't tested my 1RM for a while, but I think it was about 115, 110. So that's about 250 freedom units somewhere there. Bench is shit.
And the follow-up question is, what is your biggest regret of your latest vacation and why was it not seen chilly?
Before it even said it was not seeing Chile, it was not seeing Chile. I have no regrets. I had an awesome time. I had a month at Harvard and then a month in Europe with my significant other's family, who is Danish. It was definitely not seeing Chile. Like, it's that simple.
My ancestral roots are from Denmark. As a quick way to know that, anyone whose name ends with S-E-N, they're likely descended from Denmark.
What's up? Ricky knew straight away. She was like, Jay Larson must be Danish. Tell me about Danish heritage. Yeah.
So what was your favorite part of visiting Denmark?
So I'd actually been to Denmark once in 2013 for a music competition when I was doing that. So it was nice to go back, but I did a road trip around the Western Island with Ricky's family, and then I met her extended family. For me, probably favorite memory was going to like a big Danish family dinner for Ricky's cousin's 20th, and she sort of, that's when they finish high school as well. So we had a big family dinner with traditional Danish food in a traditional Danish house where everyone spoke Danish except me. And I was like, thumbs up. Hey guys, so good to be here. I don't speak Danish. I know a couple of sentences. Here's my favorite one. Fa, four, 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 nine, four, four, Iggy, four, 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 lab. That's actually a real sentence. what else? So that was really cool, hearing them sing the birthday song in Danish, which is like completely different to the birthday song we're all familiar with. I guess, you know, when you go on holidays and you're a tourist, or you go on holidays to play in a war machine tournament, you don't experience local life and living in day-to-day things, whereas that's a significant part of my life now, because one day we might end up moving to Denmark. So I'm sort of really integrating with the culture, going to try to learn the language properly, all these things. So having an authentic day-to-day, this is how we live, this is what we eat, this is the culture, this is what we do. I always value those experiences on holidays much more than you know, we saw this cool thing or we did this cool thing. Yeah.
Okay. Another question from Chili. What are you most excited about now that you're getting back into the game? And why is it a chance to see me again?
Chili, always have a chance to see you. Told you to come to Australia 5,000 times. Ready for you to move here. I have a spare room. Most excited for? So, again, the game is completely new to me. Again, half the stuff in Circle is new. The other half has changed. It's really been nice. I've really enjoyed list building. I think a big part of games like this are the ability for you to concentrate and get better at a game when you're not actually playing the game. There are some things where to get better, you just have to do it. So, for example, you can't get better at bench press just by thinking about it. You have to go and do it. Whereas you can apply cognitive thought actively sitting at your desk at work about, oh, this list would be really cool. I wonder what it does in this matchup. The odds of this happening at XYZ. And I've got a couple of mates that I can bounce all these ideas off, especially in my workplace, and everyone's on Messenger or WhatsApp or whatever, talking about things in their own little groups. So just the ability to go through that whole sort of educational process again. I often talked at the end of Mark 2, I was like, I wish I could just wipe my memory, pretend I didn't know anything, and relearn the game, because that was so much fun. And that's essentially what's happening.
What are you going to do now?
Exactly. The downside to that is that things are a bit more homogenous in terms of list building. Mark 3.5 was a nice shakeup. I wouldn't say it was enough, but it was good. To the point where I think there is a lot of diversity in list building. I've been building some pretty weird stuff in Secret Masters. In the Wild Hunt, I keep gravitating back to the Wild Hunt rather than Bones and Devourer's Host. Having said that, every time I write a Devourer's Host or Bones list, it feels much more powerful. So I guess I just encourage people to, or especially for myself, but people to go through that educational process, try new stuff. Internet wisdom only goes so far. Push the boundaries of what you actually can achieve in list building and understanding what models are capable of in their application, because that's really exciting. There's some really fun stuff to be explored there. Do you go through that sort of, are you constantly list building or thinking about that sort of thing still, Jay, or are you at the point where, oh, you know, these are my lists, they don't change much?
So I've been playing a couple of things have been kind of interesting for me. One is I've been playing Infernals, and list building for Infernals is kind of weird. A, because there's kind of the handicap of we still don't have all of our models out yet. And so when you're doing your list building, it's always kind of weird when you have a limited subset of models to use. But then also, it's also just kind of weird doing list building for Infernals compared to other factions, because there comes a point where, like, they have their basically two units. That I'm not sure. I don't have either sets of units, and so then you're kind of left with, you know, I don't really want to pay points for horrors because they're great if you're summoning them, but they're not necessarily worth, with potentially some exceptions. I think the lights might be a fairly good value for their points, but they're not ones generally that you want to summon. So. That's been interesting doing list building for that. All three casters play very different styles. And the other thing that's been interesting is that we, Chain Attack has been doing our Oblivion campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to do a limited series with it that we sell, where we do battle reports for each of the games. And I've been playing one side of it, and then Josh and Trevor have been playing the other side of the campaign. And so right now, the Oblivion campaign is 10 games long. We've done 8 of the 10 games so far, 80% of the way through.
Wow.
And it's been fun doing list building for it, and it's been interesting. The thing that's cool about the Oblivion campaign, and that I've enjoyed quite a bit, is that you start at like 20 points, 25 points, 35 points. And the first three prologue games, you don't have a Warcaster or Warlock, Infernal Master.
Oh, wow.
And then you play two 35-point games, two 50-point games, two 75-point games, and then the final battle is a 100-point game with two casters on each side. So, and this, you have different scenarios that are going on with it all, and doing the list building with for those scenarios, it's just been kind of a pretty exciting, enjoyable experience. So that's been fun.
Wow. So that's the question I think would be on some competitive players' minds is you're obviously a very accomplished competitive player. Would you recommend it from a competitive point of view, or from a narrative point of view, or both? Or
it is so. Some of the scenarios are, I would not say, are competitively balanced. They are narrative campaigns that are going on, or scenarios. Mm. And on some of them, Like if the two players aren't willing to like approach it from that mindset, then it can somewhat break down, because there's like, for example, there's one scenario that I'm thinking of that if one of the sides, there's a round clock on it, and if one of the sides decides, well, I don't really have any incentive to engage my opponent, and I'm just going to run away for, you know, X turns, then he'll likely win, but it will completely defeat the purpose. What you guys are trying to do. So it has been a lot of fun, but it's you definitely approach it from a different mindset than, say, a steamroller, because with a steamroller, obviously, you are approaching it with the intent of the purpose I'm doing this is to try to win the game, and I'm going to pursue whatever avenue is going to give me the best chance of winning the game. And that's not the mindset that you want to use when playing this, but that's fine, and it's still been a lot of fun.
Yeah, there's a sort of an unspoken social contract, and I think you really have to sell the narrative for people to be involved. Yeah. And if you can do that, well then, I mean, even if you have a conversation where he says, I could run away for three turns and achieve X, Y, Z. Now let's actually invest in the narrative and invest in my characters and grow a sort of story here.
Right.
That's cool. Just on while we're on that Infernal and list building topic as well, reminds me a little bit of when Convergence came out. It was like Syntherion and a handful of Jacks. Right. And then we were waiting for a bunch of releases and the different Jack chassis.
Waited forever for the Corollary and the TEP.
which were obviously faction-defining and still are. Yeah. So there's that, and there was also, I don't know if you remember as well, NMR 2, the Inflictor for Crix, the Indictor less so, but the Inflictor, I think we waited 2.5 years or something, 3 years, something crazy. However, the supply chain behind the newer limited faction seems a lot more streamlined and specific. Has that made your list building process for Infernals more enjoyable, or do you just find it frustrating having access to, you know, a third of the faction right now?
I just tell myself that I need to be patient or whatever. I mean, it is a little frustrating that some of the key solos that the faction wants have not been available, but you know, it is what it is. You can still make some really good lists and have some fun, etc. So it's not that big of a deal. I do worry that, you know, people, you might not be aware of this, but the Grimkin release was kind of perfect. The entire faction started releasing in June and was all of it was out by September. And they have not done that since then. And a lot of, I worry that some people got used to or had their expectations set by Grimkin, and then that there might be lost sales that end up happening because of the protracted releases. So,
Okay. Interesting balancing that from a running a business perspective. I think a lot of us put on our selfish hats sometimes. Yep.
Well, we have hit our time mark on this episode. We still have a question or two from listeners, and then I have a bunch of questions that I've jotted down to ask you. So we'll continue the discussion on the next episode. I want to give a special thanks to all the Patreon backers. They're the people who help make this possible. Quite honestly, if there weren't people supporting this on Patreon, then it would be difficult for me to do things like justify waking up at 6 a.m. on a Monday morning to chat with the... Although, I can always make time for you, James.
from the bottom of my Patreon backing heart, you're welcome.
and a special thank you, James, for staying up late to do this podcast with me.
Anytime.
And as always, the meta is sponsored by Discount Games, Inc. You can shoot me an email at j@discountgamesinc.com for details on how you can save even more money on Privateer Press and Games Workshop products.
I thought you were going to finish that with saving more money, period. I was like, Jay, let's talk.
okay, well, thank you very much, and thank you everyone for listening. Give me a hand.
among the gum trees, with lots of plum trees. A sheep or two, a kangaroo, a clothesline out the back, veranda out the front, and an old rock.